Okay, so let's get underway. Just a little admin point in case there's some confusion, because there's going to be two different exams for this course. If you're here as a visiting undergraduate, and you're only here for one semester, so anybody who's only here for this semester, there's an exam coming up in December. Everybody else, the exam is at the end of the second semester. So if you go to the wrong exam, then you will cause chaos, so please just, it's only the people who are here for one semester who should go to the exam, which is happening in December. In both cases, there will be two separate exams. There will be a programming exam in a lab where you have to actually write programs and you have the machine in front of you, and there will be a normal exam on the theory part of the course, which is what we're talking about today. Okay, so I want to look at some of the algorithmic issues in actually writing a standard Prolog interpreter. So far we've got the general idea of what's involved in logic programming, and in Prolog in particular. So I want to look at how we implement directly some of the things we've been talking about. So that'll be about half the time today. I want to talk about some of the features of Prolog which you've seen to some extent so far, features like what are called meta-predicates. So I want to go beyond this declarative part of Prolog, which is what this interpreter is for. And you've seen something about negation as failure, so we'll come on towards that towards the end of this particular lecture. So here I'm interested in the theory behind negation as failure, not the programming aspects which you've seen so far, and actually using it in programs. Okay, so what I'm actually going to use here is Haskell, and now I realise that about people who are doing the MSc probably haven't seen Haskell. So it's a functional programming language. I'm not expecting anybody in an exam to come up with bits of this. I am expecting people to have some idea of what the algorithms are. Now we've done in hand-wavy, pseudo-codish sort of ideas what's involved so far. This is meant to get things more precise. If you know Haskell, then I hope it will clarify what's going on. Otherwise, I think it's not, I don't think it's reasonable to follow in detail what's going on if you don't know the language. I'll try and explain the construct, but you should try and get hold of some feeling for what's involved in actually writing an interpreter for this language. And it's fairly short, right? So we've basically got pretty much the basic code in these slides. So it's not a mammoth program. Of course, there's lots of other things involved in writing a real program, pretty printing input, output, and arithmetic stuff. But the core of the algorithm is really quite simple. So Haskell, what you'll see in some of these slides coming up are descriptions of Haskell data types, Haskell functions, and some comments in the code. If you don't know Haskell, you might know Lisp, you might know SNL, so it's written in a functional programming language. You can find this if you want to grab it and run it and you can see what it does. So there's lots of other things involved, but we're trying to get hold of the heart of the logic programming aspects, not the general programming language features of this particular way of doing programming. So what are the basic data types here? So the idea here is that what you've got at the bottom under database is actually a representation of a particular Prolog program. So a particular Prolog program is made up of a series of declarations, or a series of clauses, and the clauses fit together a bunch of clauses which have the same head predicate together constitute the definition of that particular predicate. So this database, let's do it from the bottom and going backwards. So at the bottom, this database is the list of clauses which is currently in memory. The atom is the name of it. So these square braces indicate we have a list of things that we're looking at. Okay, so list of X is written like this as a data type. So this is the list of things in type X. So DB is a constructor there, and it takes a list of pairs. So first item of the pair is the atom, that's the name of the predicate, and then the clause in brackets is a list of clauses that define that particular predicate. So what is the clause? So the clause is something of this shape. So again, this colon equals equals is an infix constructor. So clause is formed by taking a term and a list of terms. So the first term is just the head of the clause with its arguments, and then we have the list of the atomic statements in the body. What are the terms? So they are either variables, or this struct is a general way of building compound terms. So we might have P of F of C. And so this is going to be a struct. So the struct here is a constructor. It's not a keyword, it's a constructor. Where are we? Struct. And this is an atom. Construct atom term. So the atom is either the function symbol or the predicate symbol. So here we've got just the string P. And now we have a list. And the first thing here itself is a struct. And the second thing is this constant C. So I write P, but this should really be a string for constant function symbols. That's fine. And C, but also the constant C here. So this would be the way of dealing with this notion of compound term. So you see it's embedded structs from within the other. So that's a general way of representing first order syntax. And the IDs, what we're interested in giving, describing variables, describing so these IDs, this notation at the top here, ID says IDs can be ints, they can be strings. Okay, so I think you would come up with something rather like that, but of course this has been designed to make things quite smooth, so it's a little bit less cluttered than the normal first order syntax, and that's because we're not distinguishing here between function symbols and predicate symbols, for example, which Prolog's syntax doesn't distinguish between these things. First order logic does for good semantic reasons. Okay, so one of the things we saw that was crucial here was operations involving substitutions. So when we try and solve a particular query, the aim is to compute a substitution which solves the queries. So the aim is to get back a substitution that says, here are some values for the variables, and if we apply this substitution to the query, then we get something which is logically deducible from the program we're starting with. Pairs of hyphens before lines indicate we've got Haskell comments, and we're trying to define the notion of substitution. So substitution here involving an identifier to a term, so mapping variable IDs to terms. So in other words, so ID there, in this case we're thinking of variables, so substitution here just is a function which, if you give it a variable, will give you back some particular term in the language. Now that looks a bit different from what we've seen so far. So far we were writing things like when we're writing it in terms of x takes the value of y takes the value of z plus 2, for example. So that tells me what I do with x and it tells me what I do with y. It doesn't tell me what I do with any other variable. But of course when I apply such a substitution, it leaves everything else alone. So everything else is like the identity. So this would be the same as any other variable, just returns itself. So these really are functions which so I can apply this to x, and I'm going to get a, and I can apply this to z, and I should get z, which is actually what we, when we define application of substitution, that's what we get. Okay, so we're interested in, these are the things we want to define. We have a substitution that's a term of that type. What happens when we apply it to a term, not just a variable? And that will depend on the data structure that we define there involving structs. We want an empty substitution or the identity substitution, which doesn't do anything. We want a substitution which is just the base case of this substitution, just maps a term to, maps a variable to one single term or a compound term, but just one variable here. And we want to have the notion of composition of substitutions. So if I have a pair of substitutions, I want to define the substitution which corresponds to applying first one, then the other. So each of these are just very short. So this is one of the features of functional programming languages, of course. So you have to think quite hard for some of these to see why these make sense. So now we're trying to define what it is to apply a substitution to a term. And in this case, it's written this way around. So unfortunately, the traditional way of writing it in literature that we've seen in the slides so far writes the substitution after it. This is an application of a substitution to a term, and we want to get back another term. So what happens if we have a substitution and we apply it to a variable? So here, this is the variables, the data type, which has a constructor variable, so it's variables within terms. And the answer is, well, since the substitution just is a function from variables to terms, we just apply that function directly. So just take that function S and apply it to I, the particular variable. And what happens if you want to apply it to a struct? Well, you should get back another struct. So if we're looking in here and we want to have a substitution which we're writing for as x for a, then what we're going to get back here is another struct. So it's going to start as before with p, and then we want to do something with the arguments inside. So we're going to get back another struct, and the first part of the struct, so this is in this syntax, this is going to be a string that's not going to be affected by substitution. And now we look inside, what have we got? So now inside here we've got a list of terms that we want to apply our substitution to. So we just map, so that's the higher order thing here. This map says take something which you apply to terms and then apply it to whole list just by applying it to each individual item in the list. Excuse me. So you can see the sort of interaction we've got between the fact that this struct takes lists of structs here, and our use of the mapping to take this particular operation which goes inside and looks at the variables and then distributes that recursively through this inductively defined data. What's a null substitution? It shouldn't move anything. So that's just that one line. What about the substitution which just takes one particular variable to a term? So we just look at the variable, see is it the variable that's involved, in which case the answer is the particular term. So we're trying to define at the level of the functions of the programming language. And otherwise you leave it alone. In this case, we've got something which checks to see is it a particular variable that we're interested in. There's the answer. If it's anything else, just leave it alone. And how do you do function composition? Well, this is the one that you really have to think most about. So we're writing infix at for composition of substitutions. Substitution S1, substitution S2. So actually, the way this is written down here, S2 is applied first. So this dot is composition. So when you take S2, it's going to go from function from variable. S2 goes from variables to terms, and now you want to compose that with the result of doing apply in the second case. So apply takes you, as we saw above, apply is going to give you back something term to term if it's given a substitution. Okay, so if you've seen this sort of style, this will make sense. If you haven't seen it, you'll take a bit of looking at it to see that this really does the right thing. The dot in the middle there is function composition, which is written as little o in some other languages. Okay, so that's to say that these can be very simply defined in this context of functional programming language. What about unification? So unification is something that this, even first order unification was notorious for there being quite a few wrong algorithms out in the literature for some time. So what we're interested in here, we're trying to unify two terms, and we're actually trying to get back the most general unification. And we're going to do it by getting back a list of substitutions here. So there may be several, but in this case we happen to know there's a unit that's general for ease of writing this program. In fact, the what we're, the real use of that list there is to deal with the case, is to deal with a case where there's no answer. So we're only using it to say either we either return the empty list or we return the list with one substitution in it. So what if we have two variables? Well, they're always going to unify, and it's just a question of saying what the answer is going to be. So you could just always say on the thing on the right, it's a substitution which substitutes y for x. This is a little bit neater because we're limiting the number of variables which are actually mapped here. So in the case where they are identical, then the do-nothing substitution is fine. So that's a nice easy case. So what about unifying a variable with a term? So this is a case where the occurs check comes up. And here we're looking at, we're doing the occurs check. Now the notation that's involved here was something to erase. So the notation we're dealing with here is the comprehension notation here. So if we're writing, let me do what's up here. Not some particular property here. So this notation says, so that involves something involves the variables x and t2. This is not the best one to do, but I like to do it also, not x. Okay, so we haven't defined what these are, but this is basically doing the occurs check of does the variable x appear in the term t2. So this notation says we want the list of terms of this shape, and this looks such that this condition holds. So this notation with the, which looks like a list notation with a single vertical line in the middle, is asking to get a list of everything that fits the first shape that has the property which comes after that. So it's like a set notation, a set of everything that has a particular property. So in this case, it's either this, if this condition holds, or it's the empty list if it doesn't hold. So the empty list means these things don't unify in this case. So we're just doing the curse check. And if the curse check holds, then we say, okay, fine, substitute this term for variable. If it's true that the variable doesn't appear, then we assign, then it's a substitution that takes that variable to that term, and otherwise unification fails. Now we've got the symmetrical case, t1 bar y. So that's simply the symmetrical version of the one we saw above. What happens if you unify two structs? So if we look through what we've got at the bottom, so it has to be the case that the strings of struct A, the A there has to be exactly identical to the B in the second struct. So I want to unify something like this. Then it has to be that these are identical, otherwise the unification is going to fail. And then it says, okay, what we're going to get back is the U's which have this particular shape. In other words, A has to equal B. If that fails, we get the empty list. That's how we handle failure. And otherwise, we're going to call this subsidiary procedure, which is list unify, which now says I want to unify this list of these two terms here with this. So I want to unify pairwise the first term with the first term, the second term with the second term, and so on. So actually, it's the case that traditionally caused the problem was actually the occurs check case, but it's also the case that it's quite easy to get the unifying of lists one wrong. So now we're doing unification of lists. So we have two lists of terms, and what we're looking for is a most general unifier, such that if you apply it, if you map the application, so you apply it to every term which appears in both lists, then the two lists become identical. So the result of applying this mapped onto every term of the list gives you two identical lists. So that means, for one thing, that the two lists have to be of the same length. So if this has an extra argument here, then this must fail, regardless of what the terms are. So you can see it, we've got this takes this into account. The lists have to be of the same length, and it should fail otherwise. Okay, so if the lists are empty, then the null substitution is fine. These two cases, let's say, if you have a non-empty, so I should say the colon here indicates the cons, indicates we've got a list with a head and a tail. So in the first case, the do-nothing substitution is fine. In the second two cases, then the answer is failure. And in the third case, well, we've got two lists. We've got the head of the first is T, the head of the second is R, and we want to get back now substitution. How do we get it back? Well, first of all, we want to unify the T and the R, so U1 is the most general substitution for T and R. And what are we going to do with that now? So now we've got this U1, and now we want to look at the remaining two lists, and we want to apply that unifier. So we're now propagating the unification we've discovered so far into the rest of the unification problems. So that map apply U1 TS, map apply U1 RS is taking the result of doing the first unification and then applying that to the other two lists, and then calling the whole procedure recursively on the rest of the lists. Okay. So that's how you're going to unify a pair of these things. And what we do with that, going back to me if I can. Yeah, so we're calling this whole thing recursive match, right? Okay, so again, it's not a long thing to write. It's quite a tricky thing to write, but it's not a long thing to write. So this is first order unification, first order terms. In this case, we know that if they unify, then there is a most general unifier, and that's exactly what we want to return. And it's unique up to renaming of variables, so it has this nice property. Okay, so the next bit is to look at the notions of proof search. So here it matters that Haskell is a lazy language. So Haskell, you can define infinite lists in Haskell, and Haskell will not set out and try and compute the content of these lists. You can ask for the first 1,000 elements in the list, and then it will compute the first 1,000 elements, but it will not then go any further. So this makes it very easy to directly write searches which explicitly construct the search space. So we're going to construct the search space, and then we write something which just goes through the search space. And because this is a lazy language, we only compute as much of the search space as we need. Of course, there are infinite search spaces in search strategies which will loop, and this will reflect that. But we can represent the whole of the search space without computing it. We only compute as much as we need in order to do this search. So these, what are called here, proof trees, but they contain this search information, they contain choice points. So we've either got done with substitution, which is the answer we want to get back, or we have a choice between a whole bunch of different proof trees or search. It would be better to call these search trees. So we're now going to construct a suitable proof search tree for specific goals. So let's think. So what have we got here? The database is going to contain the program. The integer says, what does it look like at level n? At level 3, what does the search space look like? And then at level 4, and so on. And in each case, this list of terms is the goals we're looking at some particular place in the search. So we start at some place, and then we're imagining down here. And at some particular place here, we've got a list of these things, so QRS. Those are the goals we're needing to solve at that particular point. So that's that list of terms towards the end of that declaration. Okay, so this PT is saying what actually happens at level n. We want to define what happens at level n in terms of what happens at n plus 1. Now this is the opposite way round from the way you would normally do it, but this is, we're allowing laziness to help us here when we go to compute to certain levels. Okay, so if ever we reach an empty list of goals, that means we've solved the problem. So we start with an initial query goal, and usually that expands out into a whole number of other goals, and they're only going to be solved by matching them against these unit clauses in the program. And the result of matching with a unit clause gives us, knocks one of them away. We can knock all of them away, we end up with an empty list of goals. So that's the done case. Otherwise, well, okay, it's only two lines, but there's a lot going on. So now we're saying we have a goal, G, and some other goals, and we're going to return a choice tree. So now remember that choice is one of the constructors in this data type. So choice says, well, it's the result of calling this proof tree procedure recursively at the next level. And we've got, here's where we do bookkeeping of the unifications. So at different levels we compute unifiers, but we have to wrap them all together to see what the answer is at the very top level. And now we're going to just map this, apply unifier to the other goal. So that bit on the end says when we do our first unification step on the goal, that's to say in this case G, and we get a unifier, then we apply that to all the other goals. So the unifier tells us we can solve this under the conditions that these variables have particular values. So you apply that condition to the other goals and then you proceed. Okay, so again, it's a set of things, it's the proof tree, it's the list of proof trees, n plus 1, blah, 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 such that this notation something from something here indicates that we want terms with the taken from a particular list. So at the bottom there we're looking for this notation term colon minus minus tp, remember it's the notation for the clauses, so we're looking for a particular clause tm if tp, which is in so this renaming of clauses is done to avoid certain clashes of variables, so let's not worry about this. So let's see this renaming of clauses just says we're looking up the database. So we look up the database, can we find a clause of that particular shape tm plus tp where we've got a unification, so that's the final thing, so we can unify G with TM. So G is the goal, TM is the head of the clause in the program, and we can unify those to get unifier G. So that's what we've said before, we look through, we have a particular goal, first of the goals, it has a particular, we try to find, can I unify that against the head of a clause inside the program? And if we can do that, then fine, we apply that unifier to the rest of the goals and solve what we get by appending, as you can see up there, we've got choice. So we add the clause body at the front. So let's see this map apply U to the, so the U compose. You append S's. G under substitution. TP. Yes, sorry, let's get this right. So the final thing you see at the end of the first line is TP const TP append TP appended to GS. So TP are the rest of the goals, and we're now appending them there. So again, there's a lot going on, but it's quite a short program here. And then the final thing to say is, if that describes a search space, how do we search it? And this, you can see, is very, very short to write. So if we've got a done case, then that's the answer. If we haven't got a done case, we've got a choice, and the choice just consists of a list of possible search trees. And you simply, this comprehension notation says, you want to look at the PTSs, so you want that S is from, you simply basically search through these in the order in which they appear. looks excessively at each tree and calls itself recursively. So the fact that this does the same as the standard Polyglot interpreter depends on the fact that the Haskell language, when it has one of these comprehension constructs, actually goes through the lists in the same order in which they appear, so it doesn't affect the order of what's going on. And you have to initialize this thing. Okay, so that's the basic engine. As I said, if you know Haskell, you should be able to figure out what's going there. The full code is in there. You can get that code. You can run it. And that tells us the basic way in which Polyglot interpreters work. And it also gives you an idea of what's involved in these two key subsidiary features, that's to say, substitution, composition of substitution, and unification. Okay, so let's leave that there. So this is a completely different topic. So now we're interested in going to those aspects of logic programming which take us away from this strict view of first order logic. So that particular interpreter, for example, doesn't deal with arithmetic things like is, the comparisons there, doesn't deal with things like clause and things we're just about to see. So there's a notion when you're thinking of the use of declarative languages of a situation where you have two languages. So you have one language which you're using to describe another language. So this actually happens quite a lot. So we use the term meta-language to talk about the language which describes the language which is talked about. There's a language which we're using to speak in, and we're talking about another language. So here's the sort of sentence that you get if you have English as a meta-language and French as the object language. So this is a perfectly well-formed English sentence. It says, the word poisson is a masculine noun in French. And that's a perfectly well-formed English sentence, even though that word poisson is not a word in English. Right? So in these sorts of situations where you're mentioning what happens in other languages, then they sit inside the grammar in a different way from words which you're actually using. On the other hand, we can also do it with inside one language, and this is where it starts to give you various paradoxical things happening. So you can say, it is hard to understand, everything I say is false. Okay, that's a perfectly well-formed English sentence as well. It is hard to understand it. Right? So one way of making sense, trying to make sense of what's going on here is to say, well, the start of this, it is hard to understand, is a normal use of English. The quote of everything I say is false. In that particular case there, I'm not using English there, I'm mentioning some particular phrase. So sometimes we say this is the use-mention distinction. So I can also write it is hard to understand, and then inside this I can put something which is completely non-grammatical English, and that will still make sense. So something strange happens inside these quotes. So a way of thinking of that is we're actually using English to describe English. And certain occurrences of words are in the place where we're using English to describe, and other bits of verb, and other parts are English being described. So they're bits of syntax, usually, which we're thinking about. Just as bits of syntax, we're not actually using them. So Polyglot has this sort of mixture of object-level and meta-level statements in it. So here's a situation where, in a typical normal program, you would have a statement, father AB, and that's what we consider this here as being an object-level statement. It's a statement about the domain we're reasoning about. On the other hand, here's a prologue statement which says, functor father AB, father 2. So this is something you can call in prologue. You want to know about the syntax of something, so I can call it. Decompose a term. We've got father AB. And we've seen this sort of thing for doing internal syntax and so on. X, Y. I'm going to get back, yes, X equals father this says this is in the prologue speak, this is a functor, function symbol, and it takes two arguments in this particular term here. And we also see var x, so var is something which will check whether a particular term is a variable or not. Yes. X is a variable, if you give it 2, it says no. Now, there's something very different about what's happening in the second two of those than what's happening in the first. And it's also, what's problematic here is that the father AB statement and the functor father AB, father 2 statements are both, you can mix those up inside programs, you can have both of them appearing one beside another. And it's really, it doesn't fit with inside the declarative part of prologue to mix these things together. So I want to say why. That means, it doesn't mean they're not useful when you're writing programs. It can be very useful when you're writing programs. But it's also possible to mess things up here. So what can we say about this particular var case? Well, there are two queries. So first one says, is x a variable? Var x equals 2, that one succeeds. And the second one says, x equals 2 var x, and that one fails. And the second one fails because, well, as we saw when we were looking at the interpretative goal, if you have a pair of goals, you solve the first goal, x equals 2, and now you've got the substitution, I want to substitute 2 for x everywhere. So in the second case, when you call var x, you're actually calling var 2, you're actually calling this one down here. So in the first case, this is what we called. And the second case, this is what got called when we were interpreting that program. And that depends on the fact that we deal with these from left to right. If we did it in a different order, then we get the solutions we flop around. So why is this a problem? It's a problem because it's a problem for the declarative reading. So the declarative reading says if I have a query with two commas between them, that comma is actually a conjunction. So the commas in the bodies of programs are conjunctions. So if I say, is it the case that A and B, I should get the same answer if I ask, is it the case that B and A? So conjunction, the declarative semantics of conjunction makes no distinction between the order in which I combine two statements. So if prologue is giving us back different answers here, then that says there's something going on which doesn't fit with this declarative reasoning of what happens. So this particular behavior is inconsistent with the declarative reading of what's going on. And certainly if you want to use var, then you really need to know quite a lot about the, if you want to use it in lots of situations, you really need to know about the behavioural aspects of the prologue interpreter to get the effects you're after, usually. However, this lets us do some rather nice things, the fact that these two levels are mixed up. So what about this clause predicate? So I'm not sure, I can't remember if you've seen it, but at any rate, this clause predicate is a built-in in prologue. Sometimes you have to do a particular declaration that depending on the dialect at the start of your program to make it available to you. But it is part of the standard. So in the first case, we've got a normal prologue program defining father and ancestor. And what I've got below is a description of that prologue program in prologue. So now we've got three, in this case, unit clauses. And each of these unit clauses that says there is a clause whose body is, whose head is father AB, and whose body is just true. And there's another clause whose head is ancestor XY, and whose body is father. And there's one whose head is ancestor XY, and whose body is the pair father XY, ancestor XY. So you can see you could write down that if nobody had invented the notion of clause, this would be a perfectly accurate nothing wrong with what's at the bottom there as a prologue program. It's a perfectly fine prologue program. What's built into prologue is that you can go from writing a normal program to this clause information. You can get hold of this if you do some initialization steps. In some cases, you always have this available. There are some optimizations in the compiler which work a lot better if you haven't got this clause information. If you're running a normal interpreter, if you're running a Prolog standard, then there's always going to be some way of getting hold of this information. Okay, so what's the point of this? Well, or what's going on here? So, one thing is that, I mean, the reason for doing this is you might want to reason not just about the domain you're interested in, you might want to reason about the program, you might want to reason about the way in which you're solving the program, and that's something we'll come to a little bit later on. So this allows us to change the search strategy because we can look at the shape of queries, we can look at the shape of the clauses. We won't have time to do that in much detail today, but it's a very nice feature of logic programming. So why does this break the declarative reading? So it's not just because we're being fussy about the grammars. There's a question about what exactly are we talking about here. So in the top program where we've got father, AB, ancestors, and fathers, then the domain we're thinking about is the domain of people and family relationships. What we've got at the bottom, where we've got clause something something, the domain we're thinking about is bits of syntax in a Prolog program. So if we look up above where father is a predicate, down below, father cannot be a predicate in first order logic. The grammar of first order logic says that has to be a function symbol. Clause is a predicate. Father has to be a function symbol. And the semantic counterpart to that is what are we talking about? What are the objects in the domain that we're reasoning about? So in the top case, the domain we're reasoning about is a domain that has people who are fathers in it. And in the bottom case, we're thinking about the way that the top case was actually represented. So that's what we're saying here. And one way of dealing with this is to say, actually, what we got in this second version is to say clause is actually a predicate in a different language, and it's looking at these bits of syntax which are written down. So that's to say, we treat this, we really say there are two separate languages there. And we say that the clause is in one language and the father is in another language. So one is a predicate in one language and one is a predicate in the other language. So there's a logic programming language called Gödel which developed this whole distinction systematically. So it's not been taken up enormously, but I think it's the right analysis of what's going on here. By and large, people get by as they can and don't worry too much about what's going on. So you use the declarative reading when you can, but you have to be aware that not everything is happening according to that declarative reading. Okay, so I want to say a little bit about negation as failure. Okay, so Prolog doesn't distinguish between being unable to find a derivation and claiming that the query is false. So it's ambiguous. When Prolog comes back and says no, what it's saying is the interpreter cannot find the derivation of the query from the statements in the Prolog proof. But quite a lot of the time you want to get back the answer false. The query was actually false. It's not just I couldn't prove it, the query has a truth value false. So anytime you do this, you take the Prolog response of no as indicating that the query is false, then that's using negation as failure. So you're taking the result, the answer of no, as indicating that the query is actually false. Now this is not always valid, right? So if you're really interested in what's the truth about the domain that the statements are about, then it's absolutely not the case in general, but if you can't prove something, it must be false. So maybe lots of reasons for this, so lots of incomplete information. But there may be cases in which this is a sensible way to go. And the dealing with negation in Prolog relies on this sort of situation. So there are some places where this is much safer than other places, and I want to look at these particular settings. So here's a nice situation. So sort of, it would be good if we we have enough information to answer any possible query. So let's say atomic query, So if we know that Jane is poor, and we know that if Jane is poor, then Jane is happy, and we know Fred is happy, then we can't, as it stands, we can't say anything about whether Fred is poor. But if we queried this, then we'd get back the answer no. So what are we saying here? So the nice thing here is that we can be in situations where the theory is complete. Foreground atoms, that means complete. For particular queries of the form P holds of Fred and Jane. So no variables, only one predicate. So that's a ground atom. That's what it says up here. Okay, so the what we've started with there, so this particular cell there, so that's not complete for ground atoms because that poor Fred, we can't decide it's true, we can't prove it holds, we can't prove it doesn't. So one way of extending this to get a complete theory is to use what's called the closed world assumption. So this is what's happening theoretically. So we're saying, okay, logically what's going on? Well, we might do the following thing. We would say any ground atom that we can't show, we're going to add the negation in to our logical theory. So this is not what we're doing in the implementation. This is the logical understanding of what's happening. So if the following assumption is okay, it says all the basic positive information, that's to say all the information about statements, all the positive statements here, so this one's without negations, they already follow from everything I've written down. So if you think you've caught all the positive cases, then you can use this, if you think that's right, if you are right, you've caught all the positive cases, then you can use this closed world assumption, and then anytime it comes back saying no, that no will actually mean falsity. So if you've got all the positive cases and it comes back and says no, then it must be one of the ones in which it's actually false. So how does this look like? So we say if we've got some set of statements, like the statements in the program we started with, then if we use the closed world assumption, so T is a set of statements, closed world assumption applied to that is, well, we add in, again, it's a set theory notation here. We add in the negation of any atomic thing here, ground terms, that we can't actually prove from the given program, that don't follow logically from the given program. So if we add in the negations of all of these, so we've strengthened the theory, we can now prove the negated statements, and we're strengthening it in the way in which is typical in Prolog. So we say, that's just what it is for something to follow a query Q, follow from a set of statements using the closed world assumption, it follows from the theory plus all these extra negations that we add in at this point. Okay, so now we can actually get that negation of poor Fred will follow. So we can't prove poor Fred in the query we started. The closed world assumption says add in its negation, and now in that extended theory, that is the right answer. So in this case, we can actually compute that set xt because we don't have any function symbols. So why this is absolutely not a good way to try and implement this is that this set xt here, there may be infinitely many of these things if you have infinitely many terms on there. So this is absolutely not how to implement it, but it's a sense of what's going on logically. So when is it a good idea?